The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, continued on cassette number 6, side 1. Running a statewide campaign had always been expensive in Texas. In part, this was because of the state's size. 800 miles from top to bottom, close to 800 miles across, it is bigger than all New England, with several other states thrown in. In part, it was because the state was largely rural. Only a third of its 6,450,000 residents lived in cities, a third lived in small towns, and a third still lived on farms. A substantial percentage of the farmers didn't possess radios. Some didn't even get a weekly newspaper. In 1941, the only way to reach these people was by the campaigning methods that had been used in Texas decades before. You'd put a loudspeaker on some guy's car, load up the back with literature, mark up a road map for him, and send him out, driving from one Saturday town to another to put up placards, pass out literature, and give speeches on the courthouse square, says D.B. Hardiman. Although the cost of individual items such as gasoline, hotels, and food was low, a good small-town hotel charged no more than $2 or $3 a night, a like amount would pay for a day's food, and, recalls one campaigner, you couldn't drive far enough in a day to use up $2 worth of gasoline. Overall, this type of campaigning was expensive. The campaigner needed money for car repairs and to buy fellas a beer, to be a big shot, to be able to act like an important representative of headquarters. Keeping a man on the road cost about $100 per week. Because of the size of Texas, it was desirable to keep a lot of men on the road. Just keeping in touch with these men was expensive. Long-distance telephone bills were no small item. Because of the size of Texas, the cost of every category of campaign expenditure was multiplied. A candidate who wanted to make significant impact with highway billboards had to think not of hundreds of billboards, but of thousands. A candidate considering the purchase of advertising in weekly newspapers had to consider the fact that there were more than 400 weekly newspapers in Texas. No daily newspaper covered more than a small fraction of the state, so a candidate had to try to buy space in all 60 daily newspapers. And the new and most effective medium of campaign communication, radio, was the most expensive of all. Since no radio station reached more than a small fraction of the state, a candidate had to try to buy time on 60 stations. Money had played a significant role in the 1941 campaign even before it began. The most logical candidate in Washington was Congressman Wright Patman. The 48-year-old Patman wanted that Senate seat, had been dreaming of it for years. And having earned a formidable reputation as a crusader for populist causes, he was qualified for it. But dreams had to surrender to reality. "I wanted to run," he was to say, "but I couldn't afford to run. Of course, I knew that I could do more in the Senate, but I told Mr. Rayburn, 'Lyndon can be financed. It takes a lot of money for the Senate. I don't have the money for it in 254 counties in Texas. I don't have the potential of a good organization with funds to support it. Lyndon has.'" The most logical candidate in Texas was James Allred, now retired from the governorship at the age of 42, a federal judge. Allred, too, wanted the job, but Allred was faced with the same reality, heightened in this case by the debt into which he had been plunged by two statewide races, a debt that had proven difficult to erase for an official unsympathetic to the reactionary oil and business interests that financed Texas politics. Publisher Houston Hart, a new dealer and owner of the only Texas newspaper chain as large as Marsh's, sent D.B. Hardiman and another young liberal reporter, Alex Lewis, to the ex-governor's home to promise him the support of the 7 Hart Hanks dailies and to ask him to run. "We got Allred so excited he was walking up and down and making campaign speeches," Hardiman says. But the next morning, early, he rapped on our door. He asked us to go for a walk with him, and he told us that his wife had just absolutely laid down the law to him. "Joe," Betsy had said, "for the first time in your life, you're about to get out of debt. You cannot run again." Before the campaign even began, lack of money had eliminated two of the strongest potential candidates. But Lyndon Johnson had money. It came from Washington because of ideology or self-interest. Traditional sources of New Deal funds, prodded by Tommy Corcoran, contributed, as did attorneys such as the one who made a contribution through Welly Hopkins, because he was building up a law practice, and he may or may not have had clients who he thought might have benefited. It came from New York, from the Garment District, because Corcoran assured Dubinsky and Lubin that Johnson was for labor and a liberal. "You'll be getting a liberal senator from Texas," Corcoran growled at them. "What do you want for a nickel?" And because their idolized leader was so interested in the race, everybody knew he was Roosevelt's pet, and it came from Wall Street and from big corporations. Elliot Janeway had been made to understand that the New Deal considered the election of Lyndon Johnson a matter of the highest priority. "Justice William O. Douglas would call me every third day and say, 'How are you doing for Lyndon?'" Janeway says. Janeway did well. In 1941, he jokes, he raised so much money for Johnson in New York that he created a balance of payments crisis in New York over that campaign. The funds raised were carried to Texas by trusted couriers, says Hopkins. "I was able to raise a fairly good-sized sum for those days, a few thousand dollars." He says, "I had checks and some cash." Carrying the money to Texas was a new experience, he says. "It was certainly novel to me. I had never had that much cash in my personal life." Asked in what form the contributions were made, Rowe replies, "It was all cash in those days." In fact, it was not, as Hopkins' statement shows, but a steady stream of couriers carrying cash or checks was soon heading for Lyndon Johnson's headquarters in Austin. It came from Dallas, from anti-New Deal oil men who didn't care what Lyndon Johnson's politics were, so long as he protected their profits. In 1941, the specter of federal regulation by the hated ICUS was becoming more and more of a possibility, and they needed protection in Washington more than ever, and their trusted advisor, Alvin Wirtz, assured them they would get it from Johnson. Those of the Wildcatters who had dealt personally with the young congressman could assure their fellows that, unlike Rayburn, who was far too independent for their taste, Johnson would take orders. On April 23rd, in fact, an exchange of telegrams had occurred which demonstrated the peremptory tone they used to him and his eagerness to please them. Arch Underwood, the reactionary oil and cotton baron, had asked Johnson for some unknown favor in Washington, and Johnson had not replied. At 2 p.m., Underwood sent Johnson a three-word telegram, "Tell me something." Johnson's reply, sent a few hours after he received Underwood's wire, said, "Tried to get you at Dallas, but was told you had just left. Harold Young leaving here with me Friday night. I'm going to try to do job in which you are interested before I leave." Bill Cottrell, who along with Bill McCraw was Johnson's contact with the oil men, was able to wire him shortly after he announced that he was running, "Have talked Lechner, Arch, Armstead, Brooks, Pearl, and Clark. All okay." They were indeed. A few of the oil men's contributions to the Johnson campaign are recorded. W.T. Knight, $2,000. Sid Richardson, $3,000. Clara Driscoll, $5,000. But most are not. The oil men made them in cash through McCraw or Cottrell or Wirtz. On one occasion, Cottrell handed Johnson an envelope bulging with bills. On several occasions, Wirtz, who directed the campaign from a private office away from campaign headquarters, called Wilton Woods over to it. Woods says that Wirtz gave him cash to pay various office expenses, and that the amount Wirtz gave him totaled $25,000. It came from Charles Marsh. The alacrity with which Johnson had leaped at this chance for higher political office, after promising Alice Glass that he would leave politics, get a divorce, and marry her, had led to a breach in his relationship with Marsh's mistress. He would repair this breach shortly after the election, and their relationship would enter one of its most intense phases. But Marsh, of course, was unaware of the relationship. On the day Shepard died, the publisher had pledged Johnson his support in the race, which he was to point out was for a 25-year senatorship. At first, for reasons that can only be guessed at, Johnson pointedly did not respond, and did not ask for help from this man who liked to be asked. But now, needing him, he asked, so skillfully that Marsh dropped all personal business and rushed to Texas. Marsh liked to write speeches and plan campaign stratagems. It gave him the feeling of being on the inside of politics. He spent the 10 weeks of the campaign driving his Buick convertible back and forth across Texas to be on hand whenever Lyndon Johnson arrived in a big city. As he drove, like many wealthy Texans, he refused to use a chauffeur, He dictated speeches and memos to his secretary, Alice's sister Mary Louise, who was sitting beside him, so that he could hand them to Lyndon when they met. With automobile air conditioning still unknown, some of these long drives, often on narrow, badly paved roads, were memorable for their discomfort. "In one day," Mary Louise recalls, "Charles and I drove from Amarillo to San Angelo, all day long in the heat." But he was perfectly happy doing this for the young man of whom he was so fond. And Marsh was not only writing speeches, he was getting them on the air. FCC regulations required that radio time for political speeches be paid for in advance, and Marsh paid, although this was a period in which he was, by his standards, somewhat short of ready cash. He donated thousands of dollars to Lyndon's campaign and raised thousands more. His partner, E.S. Fentress, gave $5,000 himself. Richardson wasn't the only impoverished wildcatter Marsh had helped to hold on to his leases. Jack Frost of the Bird Frost Oil Company was another. Frost wasn't interested in politics, but now that he had made his money, he would donate to any politician Marsh asked him to. And Marsh asked him to donate to Lyndon Johnson. Whenever Marsh passed through Dallas, he would, Mary Louise says, get some fellows in for a meeting. The money raised at such meetings would be pooled with his own, in his own bank account. Arriving in a city, Marsh would drive first to the local radio station, or send Mary Louise, and pay for radio time with his own checks, so that Marsh's checking account became almost an official arm of the Johnson campaign. But mostly Johnson's money came from Brown and Root. Herman Brown had wanted so fiercely to build big things and to make big money building them. Now, thanks to Lyndon Johnson, he had been able to do so, had, in fact, made money on a scale perhaps as big as his dreams. But the appetite grows by what it feeds on. Now his dreams were bigger. Representative Johnson had brought Brown and Root millions of dollars in profits. What might not Senator Johnson be able to do? On May 5, 1941, a luncheon was held in Houston, at which were present 34 Brown and Root subs, the subcontractors who had gotten a piece of the work on the Marshall Ford Dam or the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station. They were asked for pledges for the Johnson campaign. And Herman Brown did not ask others to take risks he was unwilling to take himself. Brown and Root might be breaking the law if it gave money to the Johnson campaign, but Brown did not let the law deter him from backing his candidate to the hilt. He simply took precautions to conceal what he was doing. These precautions had to be more extensive than the ones he had taken the previous year, for the scale of his contributions was larger now. Corporation checks, entered on its books as legal fees, were given to attorneys who were instructed to get the money into the hands of the Johnson campaign. They deposited the Brown and Root checks, made out their personal checks for the same amounts, or in some cases for 10% less, deducting that amount for the service, or drew cash, and brought or mailed the checks or cash to Johnson campaign headquarters in Houston or Austin, or got it to the campaign through routes more circuitous. One lawyer, given $12,500 in attorney's fees, gave part of it to his partner as a profit distribution. His partner promptly gave it right back to him, and he gave it to the Johnson campaign. Bonuses were paid to Brown and Root vice presidents, $30,000 apiece to two vice presidents, $33,800 to another, $40,000 to a fourth, who, Internal Revenue Service agents later came to believe, were instructed to give at least part of the money to the campaign as if it were their own. Within the first few weeks of Johnson's Senate run, Brown had put behind him well over $100,000. During the pre-war era, the cost of a typical statewide campaign in Texas was about $50,000. An expensive campaign might run as much as $75,000 or $80,000. Says one politician who managed many campaigns during that period, "That was what you figured you'd need to do it right. You seldom got nearly that much, but if you got that much money, you could do it right." But thanks to Herman Brown, Tommy Corcoran and Elliot Janeway and Welly Hopkins and Sid Richardson and Charles Marsh, Lyndon Johnson had a great deal more than that. He could hire talent, the best that money could buy. Soon top political reporters, lured from their newspapers for the campaign, were, under Herb Henderson's direction, writing Johnson press releases and cultivating press contacts, along with, in some cases, their editors. He hired not just public relations men, but the best public relations men, including the legendary PR wizard Phil Fox of Dallas, whose fee was a reported $300 per week. and Johnson could ensure that his press releases would be played as news stories in those weekly newspapers, and there were hundreds in Texas, whose editorial policy could be influenced by cash. Says one former Texas newsman, familiar with the practice, "You'd go and say to the publisher of a small weekly newspaper, 'If your views are sound, we'll take a $25 ad every week.'" Few candidates for statewide office had utilized this practice on a broad scale because few candidates possessed the requisite funds. $25 per week for a 10-week campaign, multiplied by hundreds of weeklies, ran into tens of thousands of dollars. Johnson could hire typists after renting chairs and desks and, of course, typewriters for them to use. One way to make an unknown candidate known fast was through letters to individual voters. Dozens of volunteers pounded out such letters, but Johnson wanted professionals as well. Soon, in a large room on the mezzanine of Austin's Stephen F. Austin Hotel, 82 secretaries were working under the direction not only of Chuck Henderson, but of experienced directors of corporate secretarial pools. So big did the Austin mailing operations become that even 82 typists couldn't handle it. The students of an Austin secretarial school were commissioned to address 7,000 envelopes a week. Veteran Texas politicians walked down from the Capitol along Congress Avenue, dominated by gigantic Johnson for Senator and Johnson for Roosevelt and Unity signs, to take a look at the hotel mezzanine for themselves. No letter-writing operation on such a scale had ever been seen in Texas politics. In all newspapers, even those whose editorial policy could not be influenced by money, Johnson could ensure the repetition of his name and of his link with the beloved president by purchasing ads. To run an advertisement in 60 daily newspapers and hundreds of weeklies cost tens of thousands of dollars in a single week. Johnson ran ads on this scale in many of the campaign's 10 weeks. He printed his own newspaper. Using the facilities of a cooperative local weekly, the journalists on his payroll composed a 4-page full-size newspaper. In it, Roosevelt's name appeared in headlines almost as many times as Johnson's. There were catchy renditions of the motto, suitable for singing. "Now all over the state, they're saying, and it's going to be, Franklin D. and Lyndon B." And of course, there was only one front-page picture, the two men shaking hands in Galveston under the headline, "Old and Close Friends." And copies of this newspaper were printed and mailed in the hundreds of thousands. Johnson bought radio time in huge hunks. 1 half-hour of time in enough stations to blanket the entire state cost approximately $4,000. And then, of course, there were those thousands of handshake billboards, which in strategic locations cost $200 or $300 apiece. Johnson's barbecues were the most extravagant in Texas political history. By now, he was employing Ed Clark's device of providing enough meat so that everyone attending could not only eat his fill, but be encouraged to take home enough for several additional meals. His rally is the most elaborate, with behind the stage that huge canvas backdrop of him and Roosevelt shaking hands and the immense words, "Roosevelt and Unity." To speak at barbecues and rallies, and to tour their home areas on his behalf, Johnson needed local lead men and stump speakers. Although few of them knew him personally, some would campaign for him because they were persuaded that he represented the New Deal. Many, however, required other motivation. Buster Kellum, Jesse's brother, reported to Jake Pickle on the reception he had received from J. Edward Johnson, an attorney who was reputedly an effective stemwinder, and who had agreed to accompany Kellum on a speaking tour for Johnson in rural counties north of Dallas. "Mr. Johnson didn't approve of my coming with just $50. I did my best to explain that there would be more as it was needed. That he didn't like and made it clear that he wasn't spending any of his money, and that since he was neglecting his practice, he was entitled to more. He also said that he hesitated about leaving unless he had at least enough money to cover 2 weeks' expenses. I have hopes that by the time you receive this we will be gone, but I do know that won't be until he has more money." The requirements of most of the lead men were satisfied, and soon scores were out hawking the abilities of a candidate they had never met. 4 years before, campaigning in a district whose voters hardly knew his name, Johnson had overhauled far better-known and more experienced candidates, partly through the use of money on a scale unprecedented in that district. Now he was using money on the same scale in 21 districts, all across Texas. Lyndon Johnson, in his first campaign for the Senate, was using money on a scale Texas had never seen. For a while, this campaign seemed to be following the course of Johnson's 1937 race. It was enlivened by a touch of humor. Because it was a special election rather than a party primary, any citizen could get his name on the ballot merely by paying a $100 fee. And 27 candidates besides Johnson had taken advantage of this opportunity. One candidate was a radio peddler of various goat gland concoctions designed to improve, among other things, virility. Another was a laxative manufacturer, Hal Collins of Crazy Water Crystals, who attracted big crowds at rallies by giving away a free mattress to the couple present who had the most children. A third, Commodore Muse Hatfield, felt that Roosevelt had not gone far enough. The Commodore favored the immediate creation of a five-ocean navy to be financed by a national lottery. The ballot also included Cyclone Davis, who lived under a Dallas viaduct and announced that he didn't have to campaign because Providence will place me in the Senate. A geologist who proposed a $50 monthly pension for everybody over 65 and a $5 pension for everyone else. A chiropractor, an ex-bootlegger, an admitted kidnapper, two bearded prophets, and two rocking chair sages, including a wealthy self-styled rump farmer who said he was for the masses, by which he apparently meant his masses of impoverished tenant farmers. There were also two candidates whose qualifications rested on their kinship with famous Texans of the past. Joseph C. Bean was a cousin of a pair of legendary Texans, Judge Roy C. Bean, the law west of the Pecos, and Ellis P. Bean, a hero of Texas's war against Mexico who had gained fame by spending several years in a Mexican prison with a pet lizard named Bill. Edwin Waller III had only one famous ancestor, but that one, Edwin Waller I, had claimed the honor of having begun the Mexican War by committing that war's first overt act, which on closer inspection turned out to be an argument between Waller and some Mexicans over the use of a small boat. Besides Johnson, there were, during the first 6 weeks of the campaign, two serious candidates, Martin Dies and Gerald Mann. The belief that Dies would make a strong candidate lasted only until he entered the race. A fiery stump speaker, the congressman could evoke hysterical cheers when he addressed the mothers of Dallas on the prevalence of communism within the American Youth Congress. But he spoke rather infrequently, doing little touring and relying on a few speeches in the big cities. And even when these speeches were broadcast, the public was often not aware of them, because although plenty of money was available to Dies for advertising, most of it went unused. He displayed an almost total lack of interest in setting up an organization beyond the boundaries of his own East Texas congressional district. In most of the state, there was no Dies organization at all. The communist threat was practically the sole topic of his campaign, and it quickly became apparent that while a hard core of super patriots would vote for him, he wasn't going to be able to add to that base. His strength, which soared to 27% the week he announced, declined week by week in every poll thereafter. Mann's candidacy was a very different story. The young attorney general's personal qualities attracted loyalty. The wording on the plaque he had hung on the wall behind his desk, "I sacrificed no principle to gain this office, and I shall sacrifice no principle to keep it," did not strike a false note with those who knew him, and neither did his habit of carrying around a Bible and reciting poetry. The most cynical politicians had to admit, as one puts it, there was a guy who you wouldn't dare to ask him to do anything slightly wrong. D.B. Hardiman, the Austin journalist and an astute observer of Texas politics, says that Mann was a very deep Christian, a very sincere man, a very clean man, politically, financially, a very gentle man. He had practically the loftiest ideals of any public servant I ever knew. He had, Hardiman says, assembled an outstanding staff because men were very loyal to him. When Senator Shepard died, these young assistant attorney generals asked him to run, and volunteered to resign and campaign for him, which meant that he would have at least the nucleus of a campaign organization. He also, of course, had a statewide name, a very respected one, as had been demonstrated by the unsolicited newspaper editorials that echoed his aide's request that he run, and by his rating in the first Belden poll, second only to Governor O'Daniel. And he had a fierce driving energy that resembled Johnson's, having launched the type of campaign that had given him his upset victory in 1938, a campaign that resembled Johnson's 1937 campaign in the refusal of the young candidate to spare himself. He was driving hundreds of miles each day and giving dozens of speeches in every corner of Texas. His intensity and earnestness made him a compelling speechmaker. Slender, clean-cut, very handsome, he was an impressive figure in front of a county courthouse. O'Daniel was still saying he didn't plan to run, and a poll taken on May 12th to determine what would happen if he didn't showed that without the governor in the race, Mann would receive 42% of the vote, Dyes 40%, Johnson 15%, and all the other candidates a total of 3%. Mann felt that Dyes was not a substantial threat because of his unwillingness to work or to organize. As for Johnson, Mann liked him, but felt the people of the state didn't know Lyndon Johnson. He felt he was going to win. In two respects, however, Mann's campaign was very different from Johnson's. A score of his former assistants were out enthusiastically working for him, an adequate campaign nucleus by traditional Texas standards. But it was not adequate in comparison with the Johnson campaign. And while Mann's workers were able-trained lawyers, they weren't able-trained campaign workers. They didn't know the local officials, as Johnson's men did. Johnson had this network of young, aggressive operators from the NYA that Mann couldn't match, says Hardiman, who himself joined Mann's campaign. They knew more about how to organize a campaign, how to get a campaign manager in each county and city, how to get people to put up placards and pass out literature and ring doorbells. Johnson's operation was just a better political operation than Gerald Mann's. The second, more significant deficiency in the Mann campaign was in its funding. Although Mann had spent relatively little in his first race for Attorney General, he had spent more than he possessed, and in 1941, 3 years after the race, he was still paying off debts from it. He told his two campaign managers, his brother Guy L. Mann and his former law partner Sam McCorkle of Dallas, that they were not to place him further in debt for this race. They didn't follow his instructions. Strapped for cash, they arranged loans from the Republic National Bank of Dallas. But the amount of money available to Mann from this loan, and from contributions from his backers, was minuscule beside Johnson's. The difference was visible in Austin, where Johnson had 82 typists on the hotel mezzanine and scores of other campaign workers, whereas the Mann for Senate headquarters consisted of Hardiman and a few other volunteers. The same contrast existed in other cities, where Johnson headquarters were filled with paid, trained workers. "We didn't have any big headquarters staff anywhere," Mann says. In Dallas, for example, my organization consisted primarily of Guy Mann and Sam McCorkle. This lack of staffing hurt in innumerable ways. Johnson's traveling teams, for example, sent back from each town they visited lists of individuals who might be potential supporters, with a little personal data on each one. When these lists arrived at headquarters, letters with a personal touch carefully added by Chuck Henderson and other expert Johnson letter writers were sent to these individuals over the candidate's signature, and repeated follow-up letters were sent thereafter to win them to Johnson's side or keep them there. Thousands and thousands of such letters were drafted, typed, and mailed. Mann could do nothing comparable. Nor could Mann's men do much traveling, not when such campaigning cost $100 per man per week. Johnson had 12 two-man teams out full-time. As for Mann, he says, "We didn't have any teams out. It would take all the money we had to keep me on the road and to buy some advertising. We didn't have that kind of money at all." It was sometimes hard for Mann's headquarters even to keep in touch with his campaigners. Telephoning over an area that was bigger than all New England, just the cost of it was an impossibility, Hardiman recalls. When Johnson traveled, speechwriters and advance men traveled with him. Mann often traveled alone, except for a single aide who had volunteered to be his driver. The influence of money in the campaign was magnified in the media. When Gerald Mann received an endorsement from a respected daily newspaper, it appeared once in that newspaper. Perhaps, if he was lucky, the paper might repeat its endorsement once. But when Lyndon Johnson received an endorsement, it was reprinted in ads or in news stories written in his headquarters in scores of weeklies throughout the Daily's circulation area, week after week. It was reprinted in brochures mailed week after week to voters across the entire state. It was reprinted in hundreds of thousands of throwaways placed in voters' hands by campaign workers, NYA employees, Brown and Root employees, electric cooperative meter readers and repairmen, FHA mortgage appraisers, who reinforced to the voters face-to-face the message in the flyers they were being handed. The most glowing phrases of such an endorsement were shouted or recited in honeyed tones on radio broadcasts over and over, day after day. Mann's speeches might be persuasive to the voters who were actually standing in front of him when he gave them, and perhaps listeners to a local radio station, but that was all. Johnson could not speak well, but when he spoke it was to large areas of the state, for his speeches were broadcast over statewide radio networks. Men, local lead men and stemwinders who had come to admire the young attorney general, wanted to speak for Mann, but after the first few weeks of the campaign, the money to send them on the road ran out. All too often, Mann's headquarters was handicapped in responding even to a specific request to furnish a prominent speaker for the meeting of some local organization. When such a request came into Johnson's headquarters, the speaker was sent, all expenses paid, often accompanied by a claque to arouse enthusiasm in the audience. Newspaper advertising drummed up attendance. When a similar request came into Mann's headquarters, expense money would have to be scraped up before a commitment could be made to send a speaker. Often it couldn't be scraped up, and the opportunity was lost. Hardiman, hardly a prominent Texan, wound up making some speeches himself because he had no money to send anyone else. Mann was mercifully unaware of the full extent of Johnson's advertising. For traveling long hours every day around the state, he would see only the local newspapers. "I was out campaigning, so I would see only one ad, not hundreds at a time," he recalls. His staff tried to shield him from the truth. "You want to keep the candidate believing he's going to win, so you don't tell him things like that," Hardiman says. But, a perceptive campaigner, Mann knew something was happening, something bad. "I could tell by the crowds," he recalls. "I don't know how to describe this. Out on the stump, you can feel if things were going right." And now he began to feel that things were going wrong. The crowds were just not as large anymore, or they were just not as enthusiastic as they should be. And gradually, the explanation dawned on him. "As I traveled around, I could just feel the effect of Johnson's money. The advertising and the employing of people, and in every county in the state there were federal bureaus, they were really putting out so much money, I could just feel what was happening." Mann was correct, but without sufficient funds of his own, he couldn't do anything about it. He was campaigning now as Lyndon Johnson had campaigned in 1937, day and night, weekday and weekend, spending 16 to 18 hours a day in a car. He became so exhausted that he could fall asleep on a moment's notice in a car. "If I hadn't been able to do that, I couldn't have been able to keep going. You can look at a map and see how big Texas is and how far apart these towns are, but you can't imagine it until you try to get from one place to another." He was, he says, almost automated. He could sleep until his car pulled into a town, wake up and jump out of the car, make a speech, get back into the car, and go right back to sleep. And he was campaigning like this day after day. But even such an effort could not help him against the weight of Lyndon Johnson's money. Mann was running a traditional Texas campaign and running it brilliantly. But it couldn't compete with the new type of campaign, Lyndon Johnson's type of campaign. There was one glaring difference between Lyndon Johnson's 1941 campaign and his 1937 campaign, the candidate himself. The candidate of 1941 bore little resemblance to the skinny, gawky, nervous youth of 4 years before. When he took off his suit jacket, it became apparent that the only part of Lyndon Johnson that was still thin was his shoulders, conspicuously narrow in proportion to the middle of his body, which had become quite wide. His belt sagged a little around the beginning of a paunch, and his rear end was now quite large. The jacket was seldom doffed, but not through concern over his bulk. His speeches, he instructed his speechwriters, were to be senatorial, statesmanlike, and dignified, and he wanted his appearance to match, as the handkerchief painstakingly arranged in his breast pocket matched his necktie. His suits, most of them with a vest, were of good materials, mostly dark blue. There was often a carnation in his lapel, and his white shirt was starched and stiff. Gold cufflinks gleamed on the sleeves. Bareheaded in 1937, now he often wore a hat, not a Stetson, but a fedora, which he would wave to the crowds, and there was frequently a briefcase under his arm from which he would remove the text of his speech as ostentatiously as if it had been papers of state. To read the speech, he would fussily put on a pair of eyeglasses. The gaunt face of 1937 was a broad, heavy face now. Flesh had filled in the lines and filled out the cheeks. There was a full-fledged double chin, and a big jaw jutted now out of heavy jowls. The candidate of 1937 had looked so young. The candidate of 1941 was not young at all. He looked at least a decade older than his 32 years. The difference was accentuated by his bearing. In 1937 he had been as ineffective reading a prepared speech as he was persuasive speaking extemporaneously. Now he almost never gave an extemporaneous talk, and he was, if possible, even worse now at reading prepared speeches. But in a very different way. In 1937 he had given the impression of being afraid to look at his audience, lest he lose his place in the text. He still did not look at his audience nearly as much as his mother, the elocution teacher, would have liked, but fear was no part of the impression he made now. On a stage he was a dominant, powerful figure, tall, long-armed. The spotlight glittered on his gold-rimmed eyeglasses, glistened off the waves of his black, carefully pomaded, shiny black hair, and highlighted the pale whiteness of his skin, the blackness of the heavy eyebrows that the glasses did little to conceal, and the sheen of beard that was present on the jutting jaw, no matter how closely he shaved. A powerful figure, but not a pleasant one. The modest tone in the text of most of his speeches, Charles Marsh, who wrote many of them, was constantly urging upon the candidate at least a public humility, was belied by the domineering tone in which they were delivered. Johnson shouted his speeches in a harsh voice, almost without inflection, except when he was especially determined to emphasize a point, when his voice would rise into a bellow. The tone was the tone of a lecturer uninterested in any opinion but his own. Dogmatic, pontifical, the tone of a leader demanding rather than soliciting support. Reinforcing the tone were the gestures, as awkward as ever, but now authoritarian to the point of arrogance. He spoke with his big head thrust aggressively forward at his listeners, and sometimes it would thrust forward even more, and he would raise his hand and repeatedly jab a finger down at them. Sometimes he spoke with one hand on a hip, with his big head thrown back a little, shouting over their heads. His attitude went beyond mere inability to learn public speaking. His rare smiles were so mechanical that they seemed calculated to let the audience know they were mechanical, as if he wanted to let them know that he didn't need them, that he was the leader and they the followers. Early in the campaign, the ability of his advance men, the skill with which they were organized, and the waves of radio and newspaper ads which preceded each speech, ensured large crowds at his rallies, and, spurred on by introductions from the best local orators, only the best were hired, and by the cheers of the Johnson campaign workers and Federal and Brown and Root employees with which it was liberally seated, the audience would welcome him with enthusiasm. As he spoke, though, the enthusiasm would steadily diminish. All too often, by the end of a speech, the only cheers would be the cheers of his claque. His speeches were invariably long, too long, not infrequently an hour or more. The audience would begin to drift away relatively soon, and by the end of a speech it would often be embarrassingly smaller than it had been at the beginning. Word about Johnson's lack of speaking ability began to get around. Despite the unprecedented publicity, crowds at Johnson's rallies began growing smaller than expected. The difference was as noticeable after the speech as during it. During the 1937 campaign, a handshake from Lyndon Johnson had been an exercise in instant empathy. Circulating among an audience with a face glowing with friendliness, he would keep a voter's hand in his for long minutes while he asked him for his help and told him that he too was a farmer and wanted to help farmers. He had established a rapport with the rapidity of a man who had a very unusual ability to meet and greet the public. Now, in 1941, that ability was not often in evidence, for Johnson did not often choose to use it. In part, of course, this was because there were so many more voters to meet and greet now, but the difference went beyond that circumstance. When, after a speech, Johnson shook hands with voters lined up to meet him, he did so in a manner so mechanical that a friend from Washington commented on it. Justice Douglas happened to be in Big Spring to make a speech on the night Johnson spoke there. As LBJ came to the close of his speech, he shouted, I want all you good folks of Big Spring to line up and shake the hand of the next senator from Texas, Lyndon B. Johnson. And Douglas noticed that Lyndon gave each of them two pumps with the arm and one slap on the back before greeting the next comer. The two-pump, one-slap technique was, in fact, one that Johnson had rehearsed. He boasted that, using it, he could, with his aides prodding the voters past him in a fast-moving single line, shake 42 hands per minute. The method was efficient, but not effective. Far from establishing rapport with voters, he only managed to emphasize the feeling that he was not one of them, and that while he might be asking for their help, he didn't really need it. And he would not allow a voter more than a hurried word or two, if that. Bill Deason says, "He never missed anybody on the street. He shook hands with every one of them, but he never let them involve him in an argument. He moved fast." In fact, he seldom let them involve him in a conversation. The candidate moved through crowds and a cordon of officious aides who pushed people aside, none too gently, hurrying him along as he flashed mechanical smiles to left and right. And his aides were around him and hurrying him along because he had ordered them to. He wasn't always so coldly mechanical, of course. With important people, some local politician he recognized in the line of voters, his face would light up and his greeting would be warm and unhurried, his handshake again as good as a hug. On some nights, his greeting of the public would also be warm, reminiscent of the campaigning of 1937. But such nights did not occur frequently during the first 6 weeks of the 1941 campaign. In 1941, his campaigning was as strikingly cold and mechanical as it had been strikingly warm and individual 4 years before. Indeed, at times, his manner was almost contemptuous, making it clear that the individual to whom he was speaking simply didn't matter. There was another difference between the two campaigns. Johnson was campaigning hard in 1941, still putting in long days on the campaign trail, but there was a marked drop in his energy level. The desperation, the frantic driving work was gone. He wasn't, in fact, even the hardest-working candidate. Gerald Mann in 1941 displayed the willingness Johnson had displayed in 1937, the willingness to do everything, to work day and night without regard to hours, in order to win. The Attorney General was determined to go everywhere, to shake the hand of every voter who wanted to shake his. Mann had done it twice before, and in 1941 he was doing it again. Johnson's speeches were, thanks to money, reaching more voters, through being broadcast, but Mann was determined to overcome that difference with sheer physical effort. Johnson was making far fewer speeches, visiting far fewer towns. He concentrated largely on the big cities, where, of course, the votes were concentrated, and in the big cities he concentrated on the big men. Arriving, he would huddle, generally in a suite in the hotel in which he was staying, with the city's political and business bosses, in Texas often the same men. Then he would make telephone calls or rest until the evening's rally. The pace was still grueling. The travel between cities made any campaign in Texas grueling. But it was much slower than the 1937 pace. It was the pace of a man confident of victory. Implicit in Johnson's delivery of speeches, in his manner of greeting voters, was the feeling that, with the mighty president behind him, he couldn't lose. And indeed, for the first 6 weeks of the campaign, the president's support, combined with Johnson's money and organization, suggested that Johnson's confidence was well-founded. Although the May 12th Belden poll showed Mann still far in front of Johnson, 28% to 9%, both his advisers and Johnson's, and the state's veteran political observers, felt that the poll was not accurately measuring the rapid shift toward Johnson, an opinion that would be confirmed by the May 26th poll, which found that Johnson had narrowed the gap from 19 points to 8, 19% for Johnson to 27% for Mann. Out on the campaign trail, Mann realized that the shift was continuing and accelerating. He knew, and Austin knew, that Johnson was going to win. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.